both the East and the West was essentially the same, through silence, through humility, through the renunciation of the complexities and temptations which may lure man into evil. It was assumed that no one was actually secure. We might feel that we have achieved a great deal, that our righteousness is enough. But even then, temptation takes on some other complicated form and we succumb. Without the grace of God, or the benediction of a spiritual force descending upon and within man, virtue is impossible to him in Western mysticism. His achievement, therefore, is that he shall become the friend of God, that he shall enjoy the love of God through obedience, through keeping the law, through practicing the virtues. And if in this process of absolute dedication to his God, his adversary shall afflict him greatly, then his spiritual estate is heightened. He is even more certain of salvation. If he is tortured, then it is obvious to him that he is making the supreme sacrifice for God. Then he is rejoicing in pain, because this pain assures his salvation and is the final testimony of his complete sincerity. If in the course of this suffering, martyrdom shall come to him, as it came to all but one of the original apostles, then indeed he has walked in the footsteps of his Savior, just as the little people of New Mexico in their penitenti rites feel that if they carry their cross and are flagellated as Christ was flagellated, they share in a mysterious way in the experience of their Lord. They become more capable of knowing him, of realizing his infinite mercy through their own suffering. This attitude was European. It led finally, of course, to the great orders of penitence that arose in Europe, the Misericordia, and other organizations, which may be termed brotherhoods of pain, pain being in some way the visible proof of internal, invisible dedication. The stories in the Golden Legend most naturally end in martyrdom. I think in many instances this legend affected the relationships between the Christian and non-Christian peoples of early times adversely. But there is no doubt in the world that this endless sequence of martyrdoms was very largely imaginary. Also, the hideous details that were added to make the stories as, shall we say, spiritually stimulating as possible, undoubtedly fashioned from the whole cloth. Instead of merely making the individual honor those who died for truth, it caused a very severe break in Christian psychology. It led undoubtedly to the development of the intolerance which has divided Christianity from other religions for the best part of 15 centuries. It was not the real circumstances that were entirely to blame, but this tremendous dramatization by means of which Christianity was opposed to all the rest of the world. And the rest of the world was really only an embodiment of evil. Even today, the Orthodox churches have a dilemma. Some distort tolerance. We want to have a broader sympathy with the spiritual convictions of other people. But how can we, if by so doing we are forced to acknowledge that they have spiritual graces without being of our faith. It seems as though we must betray the uniqueness of our own religious revelation in order to be tolerant with any other religious order. The matter seems to have arisen from this tremendous drama of good and evil. The Old Testament built largely upon the fall of Adam. The New Testament is too closely involved in the desperate effort to align the world into two camps, the camp of the redeemed and the camp of the hopelessly lost. This situation could well arise if a group of unsophisticated people began to read the martyrdom of their faith. It would seem that every other nation in the world had existed only to torment the Christian believers. Well, there was persecution. There's no question about that. But in the hagiology, this has been rather grossly overstressed. And it has even continued into modern times, and most of the books and stories that we read today relating to the relations between the Christians and the Romans, so to say, and made villains of the Romans and heroes of the Christians. Well, there was villainy, but not quite as much as has been suggested. There might be also a little villainy both ways, but that is definitely ignored. So out of this golden legend came a series of mixed blessings, we might say. There was certainly a strong statement of incentive. But the incentive was of one kind only, namely that the individual, by living a certain kind of life, would be acceptable in the sight of God, would escape the fires of eternal perdition. For most nations outside of the Christian realm, or outside of the Near East, let us say, also had their ideas about lost souls, or at least punishment after death. This arose at a comparatively early period in man's belief in immortality. But there has never been any group that has had quite as vivid a concept of this as has disturbed the Christian heart and mind. In many instances also, the older beliefs had faded out in other nations while they were still vivid with us. Even today, there are many sects in Christendom that are quite convinced of the reality of hellfire and damnation. They are not as numerous as they used to be, but they still exist. The eternal punishment for lost souls has to also have some other kind of psychological interpretation. The Greeks came probably the nearest to any in solving this problem. Namely, that perdition is simply the state of unenlightenment. An individual inhabiting a vicious nature is suffering the torments of hell. The person whose desires are frustrated, becoming angry, and perhaps so desperately unhappy that he may even kill himself, is certainly the victim of a torment within his own nature. The old peoples had no real understanding of how a person could torment himself so completely. So they had to have a little outside help to make things more difficult for him. Actually, the entire concept of damnation was legitimate in its day. People believed it honestly and sincerely. But it again represented a very inadequate interpretation of a belief. It was something that really never satisfied any of the essential requirements. While there is no cosmogony or anthropology in the Golden Legend, it does unfold a kind of universal theme of things. It was the basis of the first great books that were written in Europe concerning the origin of the world and the origin of humanity and of civilization. Like nearly all of these other early works, it was completely Western in its focus. It knew consciously, or at least admitted, to practically no world except the Mediterranean culture. Here, in the Golden Legend, was set up a way of life, an order of life. At the upper apex of this entire problem is the eternal glory of God and the establishment of a great trinity of spiritual power, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. These beings are sometimes shown seated upon a rainbow. And at one time in Europe, there was a tendency to represent the Trinity by a three-faced deity. This actually arose in Christianity, and there are images of God as a Holy Trinity with three faces and wearing the tiara. This was something that did not, shall we say, catch the public fancy in the West, so examples of it are found only in early cathedrals and very rare out-of-the-way places. But they do exist, and they have been reproduced in the past. This idea of the Trinity, perhaps the men moved in from Asia, but it was not popular. It never took hold. We do find mother-headed deities among the Egyptians. In the Greeks, they are nearly always limited to demons or monsters of some kind. Below the Trinity, the Holy Trinity, and the family of the deity, was the great arch of heaven, the wall of the firmament, which divided the celestial region from creation below. Sometimes deity is represented holding the world in its hand. Sometimes it carries the orb as the symbol of dominion, the scepter as the power of rulership over all things that live. The triple papal tiara, of course, represents the rulership of the three worlds, heaven, earth, and hell. Below the power of deity was gathered the assembly of the redeemed. Here were those who were saved according to the symbolism of the book of Revelation. Here were the elders that fell down to adore before the throne. Here were the blessed souls of the martyrs and the heroic dead. Here were the souls of the little children who had been baptized and redeemed. Likewise, in this area, were strange creatures from the mythology of every land that we can imagine, as strange and wonderful as in the apocalyptical description. Then there was a wall that divided the heavenly region from the visible world. Only the mystic or the seer could penetrate this wall and ascend finally into the presence of the eternal. Below this was the material world, and the material world fashioned, as it was, according to a strange molding, a strange precipitation, as discussed in ancient Jewish metaphysical books. This was the world that was cast out of glory. The physical world was the fallen world. It was the world of mortality, of ignorance and superstition. It was the world of penalty and testing and trying. It was a world that existed only in order that human beings could make the decision between virtue and vice. It was a world of opportunity to be good and constant temptation to be evil. And when the angel with the flaming sword cast Adam and Eve from the sidereal garden, this angel stood at the gates of the lower world to permit no one to leave, except according to the laws and prescriptions of the faith. Well, this lower world was really under the power of evil. But in the early times, this power of evil was acknowledged largely for what it was, the prince of materialism. It was the world of visible and physical things, the world in which men struggled in darkness, seeking in one way or another to sustain themselves, to earn their bread by the sweat of their brows. Men fell into this world as punishment. And in this punishing sphere, this lurking shadow of the prince of death was ever present. For this world was circumscribed by birth and death. And in this shadow was the power waiting to receive the souls of the dead, as in the Egyptian ritual. These souls were weighed or tested, or their names were sought out in the Book of Life. If they had lived according to their faith and had lived nobly, they might go to join the blessed souls. If they did not live nobly, upon them all types of terrible punishments were inflicted. And they were assumed to go to everlasting despair. Here, I think, however, we have a little exaggeration over the original intent. I think the Egyptians probably gave the archetypal pattern, namely that those who did not achieve illumination and who did not therefore pass out of this life spiritually mature were simply required to be reborn again into material existence, and this was the symbol of perdition. The Egyptians had a monster called Typhon that devoured the souls of those that did not pass the judgment of the dead. And the souls were carried through the body of Typhon and were reborn in the material world. And this, I think, was the original meaning that got lost, however, in the early centuries when Christianity neglected the doctrine of reincarnation, which it had originally accepted. So the perdition, the world of pain and sorrow, was the world of mortal things to which souls might return again, to suffer all the mysterious and horrible penalties described in Dante's Inferno. But as Plato pointed out, all these symbols of the horrors of perdition were simply caricatures of material life. They were merely aspects of the kind of things that could naturally symbolize our excesses and our deficiencies. The individual who dies in hate is burned by the fires of his own passion. Would he not then properly be born into a region of hate? And where could he find a better place to be so born than in this world? For even now, after thousands of years of civilizing, we are still inclined to hate each other. We hate those who oppose us even now. We hate to give the rights and privileges of existence to those who differ from us in any respect. Thus, all the infirmities that we suffer are karmic, and perdition is apparently the Christian name for karma. It is simply retribution. So in this region of retribution in which we all live, escape? The answer to this appears to be that we escape through instruction of some kind. We escape through being invited to improve life by the birth within our own souls of a certain spark of insight, which as it develops, gives us greater strength to resist the pressures and temptations of the outer life. In this respect, therefore, as in Oriental philosophy, there is recognized an order of teachers. And this order of teachers includes the heroes of Greek tradition, the demigods of the Nordic legends, and the divine mortals of the Buddhistic philosophy. These are, in truth, the arhats. But the arhats are those that sometime, somewhere, long ago, took the obligations of dedication. They, while still weak and infirm in their spiritual abilities and their spiritual resources, still most solemnly dedicated not only the life they were then living, but all the lives that would come to them to the service of their fellow men. Indian philosophy recognizes, therefore, this peculiar kind of dedicated souls. These dedicated souls are the virgin youths of ancient Hindu thinking. They are set apart, and at each incarnation, their destiny comes into manifestation with them. These dedicated persons, as arhats, are never completely aware of the fact of their own dedication. In fact, we are told that Buddha did not know in this world that he was a Buddha until the illumination. Up to that time, he was merely a truth seeker. But deep within himself was an achievement already highly advanced, whether he was conscious of it or not. The same of the arhat. He has achieved a spiritual worthiness, which his name implies. He comes into this world like everyone else, born into the same infirmities and problems and situations. Therefore, the infinite diversity of appearances and attributes associated with him. There is one difference, however. In him somewhere is this spark of dedication. He is by nature not as unkind as those around him. He is born more patient. He is born perhaps more forgiving, or perhaps with an innate dedication to some humanitarian purpose. All over the world, individuals are born like this. They are born to live for others. They do not know why. They simply feel that way. And in the old philosophies, it was believed firmly that these persons so born were actually the manifestations of a dedicated group that had arisen in remote time and in a long, wonderful procession walked down the ages, taking birth here and there, but always for one purpose only, the benefit of mankind. These individuals developed gradually great heroic abilities. They became far more advanced in their conduct than the people around them. We can look down through history and we can say, could this not have been true in the case of Socrates? Was he not born to be of benefit to mankind? Did he ever for a moment swerve from his hold and duty? Did he not finally die rather than compromise his principles? But it would have been very easy to save his life. Was not Plato such a man? How shall we say also that great musicians and great artists, great scholars, great scientists, if they be persons of noble dedication, are not actually the mysterious arhats that are described in the wonderful sutra of the Lotus of the Good Law? These set aside ones whose lives are for virtue are represented in art as forming a radiant company around the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. They may look upon the face of truth and live, and part of its light will be reflected to shine from their own faces and through their own eyes. I think the original concept of saints has the same origin. People watching their neighbors were aware of something. We do not watch our neighbors very much anymore, except when they want to borrow something. But in the old days when people grew up together and children played with their neighbors and the whole village knew each other, the village knew that every once in a while a wise old man appeared among them. Perhaps he was merely a craftsman. Perhaps he made shoes or cut headstones for the local cemetery. But he was a wise man. He was a good man. And in his face was the light of peace. And children loved him. And those in trouble came to seek his help. And in a simple, natural way, he was always willing to help. This man was seldom rich. He was not powerful, but was humble, not only by necessity, but perhaps by choice. He had few ambitions, wished no advancement, but simply wanted to live the life of a quiet person, helping his friends, and making some simple contribution to the economic security of the neighborhood. These, perhaps, were also I. The individual didn't have to know. That is a very important part of the story. The ahat did not know he was an ahat. He only lived as an ahat. But because he so lived, the long chain of his karma was ripening him for enlightenment, for the final illumination. The miracles of the ahat were probably the same in the east and west. The miracle of the kind word, the transforming power of the encouraging statement, the wonderful restoration of faith in man simply when he meets another person who is essentially good, the wonderful inspiration of patience, of responsibilities well met, of humility and natural righteousness. All these things transform other people. And they produce the miracles of faith and salvation. So out of this concept of the good man, undoubtedly arose the belief in the saint. The saint was only the very good man. Because he was good, he was beyond temptation. Socrates did not hesitate to die for his principles. And all over the world, good persons have given their lives to the service of others and have not necessarily been martyred, but have fallen victims to many ailments and ills trying to save other people. The man who dives in the river to save the child saves the child and drowns him. Yet there is some strange nobility about this, and only certain men will do this. They do not know why. But there is something in them that is not in everyone else, or at least has not been developed to the same degree.
who it would not be amazing or remarkable that a really devout person, faced with either penalties or the preservation of his integrity, choose to give up his fortune for truth, choose to relinquish office rather than corrupt it, to choose to die in virtue rather than live in vice. These people exist. They always have existed. And in the early hagiology of the church, many such persons of a rather heroic, mysterious, and then even remote time, who exemplified such virtues, came to be regarded with exceptional grace. It is man's instinctive veneration of good, but it is also his instinctive realization that behind good there is some kind of a machinery, that it is not just an accident. That men do not suddenly decide to be good for no good reason. But the patient man has something behind him, perhaps ages of patience. But the person who returns good for evil does so because of a strength that many others do not possess. Millions of good Christians appreciate the virtue, but not all of them can practice it. When we find a person practicing magnificently that which we might long to practice, but lack the courage, we pay tribute to that person inside of ourselves. We may not acknowledge it, but we respect it. And out of this respect for those whose spiritual achievements are extraordinary, came in the East the Arhat concept, and in India the Mahatma belief, in the Taoism of China, the marvelous sages with their metaphysical powers, and in Christendom the saints. They are all brothers under the skin. They are all one concept developed according to the conditioning of various cultural patterns. The saint is therefore the unfolded self. And in psychology we know that the elder, the patriarch, the wise one in ourselves becomes more or less the symbol of enlightenment and of the capacity for enlightenment which we all inwardly possess. The saint, consequently, also becomes the intercessor. The saint stands between God and man to prove the possibility of man achieving identity or unity with God. The saint is the one who proves that it can mysteriously but wonderfully be accomplished. It is a demonstration before the ages that virtue can win. The man has always had a respect for these virtuous ones. He may martyr them, but he will ultimately canonize them. He will seldom revere them during their lifetimes because they have interfered with his selfishness. But as he also disappears and new generations that are not touched by personal motives arise, the good man is elevated to his proper destiny. The Arhat is therefore a link indicating a state of consciousness mid-distance between man and deity. It represents, in the Eastern way of thinking, the middle distance between ignorance and the complete illumination. The abode of the Arhats is the paradise of Amitabha, which is the middle ground between earth and heaven, even as the Paradiso of Dante stands between earth and heaven. It represents, therefore, as far as we can put the parts together now, the empire of the good, the over souls, who are to become the citizens of the New Jerusalem. Now, in trying to work this out physically or historically, we see that we're up against a terrible obstacle. We have no evidence whatever that we are going to be able to build a New Jerusalem that is going to be any better than the cities we now inhabit. We have no faith that our own skill is going to finally be so dramatically transmuted that it will become the true skill of love for life. We do not. We don't feel any confidence in this. But if we realize that there was a tremendous pattern of karma moving behind all this, that there is, as the Buddhist points out, this tremendous body of testimony, that when Buddha gave his great sermon at the Vulture's Peak, the arhats from the 10 worlds all assembled, and the rows and rows of shaven-headed monks extended to infinity. These were the saints. They were not the saints in the sense of being canonized individuals, obviously functioning. These arhats were the internal achievements of all people. They were the innumerable levels of self-mastery. They represented dedication. According to the Buddhist belief, the first time the individual, unselfish, dedicates himself to good, even for one moment, even if with the full contrition of consciousness, he recites the Nembutsu, resolved at that moment in himself that he will dedicate his own evolutionary future to the good of mankind. In that moment, according to the tradition, a lotus seed drops into the pool of Amitabha's paradise. And from this lotus seed will grow the throne of the Bodhisattva to be. Once this dedication is made within the person, it cannot die. It may take a thousand lives to come to flowering. But once that seed is planted, once the individual has had one moment flash of true insight, something happens that can never change, can never be taken away. You consciously may forget it in a moment. You may never realize that anything important has occurred to him. But in that moment of heart dedication, something has been planted within himself. This is the seed of his own eternal salvation. Those in whom this seed has been planted are the army of the redeemed. The 144,000 will be saved. And this number is simply a Kabbalah on the total population of by mankind. It is all souls, which is also an Oriental belief, that all things that live will ultimately be redeemed. But those who have consciously dedicated themselves to this labor, have taken on all of the burden of the karma of regeneration. This dedication is not going to make life easy for them. In the name of this dedication, they may be born and die many times, and they may be martyred. They may voluntarily sacrifice their lives for countless causes. They may take body in backward groups and be subject to ridicule and persecution. They may lead religious reforms and die martyrs because of the hatred of their fellow men. But if this dedication is true, every step forward in conviction is enlarging the heroic estate of that soul. In the fullness of time, it will emerge as a potential world teacher, a universal servant, one of those who are born to serve others. This order that has been impregnated with the consciousness of reality, this middle kingdom between gods and men, and in Christianity, this place is the place of the saints. Many years ago, I talked about many of these problems with the present ecumenical patriarch of the Greek Church, the head of the Eastern Catholic Church of the world. And he assured me that the early church was fully aware of the secret rituals and initiations of Egypt, that he was perfectly confident that their symbolism was derived from the most secret traditions of antiquity. That in some mysterious way, the great wisdom of it all had been blocked out. That instead of being developed as Eastern wisdom had been by the constant enlargement of insight, constant strengthening of the knowledge and persuasion of the great religious truth. But in the West, for some reason, by some circumstance, everything had slowly faded out except a very simple moral teaching. That perhaps this was due to the peculiar nature of the people who had to be reached. Even the Buddha says, look at your man before you preach your sermon. And it is true beyond question that if the individual is incapable of understanding, he will misunderstand. So in the West, the tendency was to take all of these more complicated truths and reduce them to a single factor, and that was sincerity. The sincerity of the person was his salvation. His faith, his gentle acceptance, which required no explanation or no reason other than that it was the will of God, seemed at least at that time to be the most appropriate. And very likely it was, because there was very little to build on. You were dealing with an extremely simple type of human mind, a mind unlearned and unskilled, a mind that wanted only the most simple and inevitable beliefs, the belief in God to comfort the soul in sorrow, the belief in salvation to make a life here endurable, even though it might be full of pain and sorrow, the hope, the constant hope, that the inevitable sinfulness of nature might be cleansed by the grace of God and the healing blood of the Lamb. These simple beliefs demanded very little of the individual except to try, that he makes some kind of a dedication, that he makes make a choice to serve either God or evil, that he strive with whatever courage and strength that he has to keep faith with the Scripture as he understands it, with the faith as it is taught to him, to enter the cathedral or the chapel of the church prayerfully, and with all the devotion and heartfulness that he could. If this warmth of simple resolution could carry him, something happened in him. It was no longer a problem as to whether he achieved a great obvious spirituality. It was not even so much a problem, perhaps, as to where myth began and facts ended. Perhaps this was another way in which the effort was made to create this simple moment of dedication in which the pearl of great price might be placed in the human heart. Bamy seems to give us something of this. But the whole virtue of the procedure was a total giving up of self in complete obedience to the divine will as it was understood. Perhaps the understanding was faulty, but this is not too important. Many faiths will prove faulty, but faithfulness will never fail. The individual who is sincere, even though his faith may be inadequate, experiences the wonderful internal growth of his own sincerity. That is one of the differences between Eastern and Western thinking. In the West, salvation depends upon the faith being true. In the East, salvation begins and ends and depends upon the individual being true. True to that which he believes. If he believes, as some islanders did, that a dinner plate that was washed on the shore was a deity, and to that dinner plate they gave allegiance, and to that dinner plate they made their obligations of integrity, that integrity is what counts. It is not the face of the deity you worship, whether it be invisible or of wood or of stone. It is the worshipfulness in yourself that sets the mysterious evolutionary processes of spirituality in motion within us. Thus, it may not be fair to say that the golden legend did not cause soul seeds to fall into Amitabha's pool. It is not fair to say that this simple, if somewhat to our mind, gruesome belief did not at that time meet a need, did not cause the person to be a little better than he would otherwise have been, which was the essential purpose. There is no use really saying that had it been taught better, we could have changed the course of history. This is not really true. We are teaching better today, but our history is as bad as theirs was, but in a different way. All of our insight has not ended war. All of our knowledge and skill have not caused corruption to decline among us. Therefore, we cannot say that any particular degree of insight will save the individual who is innately selfish. But if something can strike at the root of his selfishness, if something within himself begins to venerate a power superior to himself, a standard of virtue greater than he has previously experienced, then in consciousness he moves along. The souls that lived in Italy at the time when Jacobus de Voragine was writing his book went out of embodiment. Maybe they're back again. Maybe they've been back more than once. The great question that really concerns all of us is whether in some way, for that time and under those conditions, these souls received lessons, came to degrees of insight through simple piety, came to understand God through the most common simple service to their fellow men, whether such may not in turn have a great effect upon the course of the spiritual unfoldments of these beings. It all probably fits together to make one tremendous pattern. And this pattern is the gradual unfoldment of all beings through the so-called process of the elevation of saints, first through beatification and finally through canonization. Beatification really corresponds very closely to the state of the arhat in the northern school. Canonization corresponds to the Bodhisattva state. They probably are interchangeable in meaning. They may also be actually interchangeable in the psychic processes which produce them. But they are not interchangeable in the common parlance in which they have been stated. So the study of the Golden Legend simply is this legend of the growth of the spiritual power of man, the legend of humanity led by the saints of old and being constantly impelled to personal sanctification, so that perhaps in some day in the infinite future it will be true that the new heavenly city can become part of the earth. Not because men have made a sudden reformation of themselves in some dated year, but because the constant enrichment of consciousness behind the souls that come into birth, that the souls coming in discover a little more quickly in their maturity the destiny for which they were intended. And instinctively, they turn from worldliness to the service of each other, placing friendship and truth above all considerations. Today this may happen when a man is 65 years old, but it is still an awakening. In another century, it may happen when a man is 55 years old. If it ever happens when a man is 25 years old, then we will probably have a different world. All these processes are parts of motions, and I strongly suspect that the old symbolism of the mysteries and the religious philosophies of both East and West can be traced symbolically in the design of the martyrology of the Christian saints. It is a difficult pattern to trace, but I really sincerely believe it is there, and that many of these legends and stories are simply adaptations from the achievements of the great and the good of all nations, gradually transposed into a Christian setting. In any event, there is something rather worthwhile if we can go beneath the surface, and for the sake of our own souls, it is always better to look beneath the surface for the truth there than to be disappointed or in some way offended by surfaces. We are nearly always the victim of surface thinking. The moment we go below the surfaces of things, we begin to find the identities of life and truth. Well, our time is up, so I guess we'll have to conclude it for this time. Thank you very much.